Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. I'm Glenn Moberg, and today on Route 51, we travel back in time to the 1860s, a terrible time when the young American Republic was split in two, enduring a civil war that killed hundreds of thousands of people in both North and South, and wounded many more. It was also a time of great advances in medicine, spurred to no small degree by the crisis of having to care for so many casualties on battlefields all over the country. Our guest today is Dr. Gordon Dahmon, the founder of the National Museum of Civil War Medicine and the author of Images of Civil War Medicine, A Photographic History, also the pictorial encyclopedia of Civil War medical instruments and equipment. Gordon Dahmon will be speaking this Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock at the Woodson History Museum, 410 McIndoe Street in Wausau, and his appearance is free. Also joining the conversation today, UW-Marathon County's own resident Civil War expert, Associate Professor of History, Dr. Brett Barker. Well, this is a fascinating topic to many people, particularly in central Wisconsin, with our extraordinary medical facilities, Aspirus, the Marshfield Clinic, and Ministry Healthcare. If you've got questions about battlefield medicine during the Civil War, we'd like you to join the conversation. Give us a call at 1-800-780-9742. Gordon Dahmon, thank you so much for being with us today. Well, apparently we have lost Mr. Dahmon, so we are going to try to get him back. And what we're going to do is play a little bit more of the Civil War theme while we reconnect. And incidentally, this version of this particular song is performed by the South Beach Chamber Ensemble. It was actually recorded live in our Wisconsin Public Radio studios a year ago. So let's listen in and let's try to reestablish contact with Dr. Gordon Dahmon. And now, Dr. Gordon Dahmon, thank you so much for being with us today. We lost that phone connection, but thankfully we were able to reestablish it quickly. Good to have you on the show.
Well, it's a long way down from Wausau to Illinois, but, you know, you got to get through the Packer Bear stuff, so I'm glad to be with you guys.
An offensive front line or something on the telephone connection there. Gordy, say hi to you don't mind if I call you Gordy, do you?
You can call me anything you want, but Gordy's fine.
All right. Say hi to Brett Barker.
Hello, Brett.
Who is fascinated by the Civil War also.
Hi, Gordy.
Hi.
Dr. Dahmon, you're giving a lecture on Civil War medicine this Saturday at the Woodson History Museum. What are you going to be talking about?
Well, we're going to try to give a lecture on the real thoughts about what, you know, when I started a museum years ago, the real thoughts about Civil War medicine, because there's so much misconception about Civil War medicine at that time. You know, everybody thought they were bloodthirsty ghouls who wanted to cut off arms and legs. They didn't use anesthesia. They didn't use, you know, and biting the bullet syndrome. So when I started this project back in 1992 to set up the National Museum of Civil War Medicine, we wanted to tell the true story about what happened in Civil War medicine. And what happened in Civil War medicine made medicine in the United States one of the greatest things ever happened, because it took us out of the doldrums and moved us into the next century.
Well, tell us about this National Museum. It's in Fredericksburg, is that correct?
It's in Frederick, Maryland.
Frederick, Maryland, okay.
Okay, Frederick, Maryland is 40 miles west of Baltimore and 50 miles north of Washington, D.C., and 35 miles south of Gettysburg, and 30-some miles east of Antietam, which is
right in the
logical
middle of,
place to put it.
Right in the middle of the action. How did you end up starting this thing?
Well, the collection grew. When I moved out here in 1971, when I got out of the service and started collecting medical items of the Civil War, I wanted to tell the true story, and then I started collecting all these items in 1988. My dear wife, who's not with us tonight, but she's at a swim meet with my grandson, But she said, what are we going to do with all this stuff? Because there's always 3,000 items. I said, well, I want to create a museum. And she thought I had a stroke or something like that. But then the thing grew in my mind, and then we wanted to put it out on the East Coast at Antietam, and it grew, and then it didn't work out at the National Park Service, but Frederick Marilyn heard about us, and then we've been there since 1998, and it's a great museum. We have 17,000 square feet of museum space out there, and it's only dedicated to medicine of 1861 to 1865.
What kinds of things can people see if they go there?
We're going to show you everything. I mean, we don't have a an ambulance system, but we show you about surgery at that time. We show you about medical education at that time. We show you about camp life at that time, where disease killed three or more four soldiers from disease, you know, just diarrhea, dysentery, typhoid fever, all these things kill the soldiers rather than bullets from the Civil War in battle. But then we teach hospital care. We teach about the evacuation of wounded soldiers off the battlefield. So we teach you the true story of what Civil War medicine is all about.
Well, you're going to be appearing at the Woodson History Museum, and Brett Barker, you're associated with that museum. Tell us a little bit about our own history museum here in Wausau.
Sure. Well, the Woodson History Center is part of the larger Marathon County Historical Society buildings with the Yockey House across the street, and this is where we hold programs, and this is where Dr. Dahman will be appearing. And we have regular programs on a variety of subjects, including Civil War occasionally. We have a Civil War exhibit right now, which is why one of the reasons we're bringing him up now.
If people go on Saturday, again, it's at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and it's free of charge, what can they see at the exhibit?
There is an exhibit about Marathon County during the Civil War, and it really looks at the larger issues of the war and then brings it back down to the local level and talks about some soldiers who served from this area and some of the issues about the home front and things like that.
Brett, what got you interested in the Civil War?
Well, that's sort of like when I heard a pause when you asked Gordy about that. It has always fascinated me. I think it is the stories. I think it's the people. And over time, I became interested particularly in what was going on in the North. I grew up in Ohio and now live in Wisconsin, and those places and their experiences drawn me over time.
And we understand that you're doing your own study on one aspect of the Civil War that hasn't been covered much.
Right. Well, I think the Northern home front has not been looked at nearly as much as a lot of the battlefield issues and soldiers' life and some of those things. So I'm interested in what life was like in Wisconsin during the Civil War and other places in the Midwest. And just the big question is, you know, what motivated them to continue to fight?
After they lost all of those battles at the start of the war, somehow they hung in there.
Right. I think people who know a little bit about the Civil War know that the war did not go well for the Union in the first couple of years, particularly in the East. And the topic we're talking about today, the death tolls lengthened. Many of those men were dying of disease more than were dying in battle. And as the toll lengthened and as more sacrifice was asked, as changes were asked, why did Northerners continue to persevere? At least a majority of them say, we support this war effort to bring the Union back together and also eventually to free the slaves as well.
If you've got questions about the Civil War, about the North's participation, about medical history of the Civil War, the advances in medicine, what it was like on the battlefield, we invite you to join the conversation here with Gordy Dahman and Brett Barker at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Gordy, you make your home in Leona, Illinois. You're a dentist by trade. Same question I just asked Brett. What got you interested in the Civil War?
Well, I'm retired now after 42 years of dentistry, but what got me interested I went to an all-boys Catholic school, and there was a little Catholic nun who taught English, and she was about 5'2" tall, and you know how the little nuns talk about. And she was a basketball. She loved basketball, but I played football a lot. And she'd always say to me, Mr. Dahman, why do you go out there on that football field and get all dirty and break your thing and da-da-da-da-da-da? And all this, I said, well, I just kind of love it. And she said, well, it's now come time for a book review. So all my buddies were getting the little small book, but she gave me Carl Sandburg's Abraham Lincoln unabridged.
Oh my!
Which I had to read, and
that's like what, 500-600 pages?
Yeah, and I thought, jeepers creepers, this is not good. But I said, I started reading it, and I grew up in Peoria, Illinois, which is not too. It's about 100 and some miles from Springfield, and my dad was a historian, kind of a historian, and we always go to Springfield in the spring and there was summer, and we'd go to the Lincoln Tomb, and kind of the light, you know, like the light bulb goes on. And I said, I just love this period of history. But I had an appointment to West Point, and then my knee blew out in a football game, and I couldn't go to West Point. So my family dentist said, why don't you become a dentist? And I said, why don't we become a dentist for? But I was pretty good with my hands. I built my house. So okay, I went to dental school, and then it kind of, you know, dental school didn't, you got to do your own thing. And then I was stationed out east for 1 year, and we were near Washington, D.C. I did some TDYs at Walter Reed.
And what's a TDY?
TDY is temporary duty. So I would take some courses down at Walter Reed. And then Karen and I, my wife, who kind of dragged along, she was not in the history at that time, and she said, okay. So we'll go out to Bull Run, and we went to Gettysburg. We went all these battlefields on the East Coast, and it just kind of soaked in. And then once we moved out here to Lena, and I said, I want to collect medical artifacts from the Civil War and write about it. So that's when it all got started.
Well, there you go. And you collected quite a few of them, and they're on display at this one-of-a-kind Museum of Civil War Medicine in Frederick, Maryland.
Right.
Well, Dr. Dahman, probably 100,000 books have been written about the Civil War. Why did you think you should write another one?
Because there was so much misconception about medicine at that time. Everybody thought that these surgeons were bloodthirsty ghouls who loved to cut off arms and legs because that's the way they were taught in the 1850s how to, you know, combat this problem. And also, the bite the bullet syndrome. I have a real problem with the bite the bindrums bullet syndrome.
The idea that you don't get anesthetic, so you have you know, just kind of grit your teeth and bear it as they're sawing off your arm or your leg in a primitive field hospital with no sanitation. That is the image most people have.
Yeah, that's the image. You know, everybody's seen Glory, the movie Glory. It's a good movie. It really is a great movie about the 54th Massachusetts and everything. But in the beginning, they show this surgeon, Captain Shaw, who's wounded at the Battle of Antietam, which is in 1862, early in the war. So he's taken to a field hospital outside of Antietam, which I probably know where it's at. And they take him in, and there's a hospital steward, and he's taking out the fragments. But then they have a guy next to him who's, don't cut anymore. Now, they had anesthesia at that time, and they if you look at the movie, it's really, they pull a white drape between him and what's happening. Now, that didn't happen in the Civil War. And they have anesthesia. The biggest misconception I have about the Civil War is people don't say, well, they just cut off arms and legs and they held their hands down and everything like this. But they had chloroform and ether, which was developed in the 1840s, and it was very highly regarded in the 1850s, 1860s.
Did they use chloroform more or ether more? Did they sometimes use both of them together?
It, depending when you're doing things. Chloroform was a debilitating anesthesia because it takes heart tissue or muscle tissue down, so you can't have people down more than about 15-20 minutes. But ether was there at the time, but if you get ether close to a flame, it's going to blow up like a hand grenade. And I'm going to show you, you know, on Saturday, I'll show you a can of ether anesthetic, and if you get that close to the flame, it's going to blow up in your hand. So most of the time they use chloroform. And they used chloroform all the way up into the probably the 1880s, 1890s.
Now, is it true that a lot of these amputations, and that was the most common form of surgery, correct?
Right, right?
That most of them didn't even take place indoors. They were outdoors on stretchers or in tents, under the bright light of the sun.
That was the main thing. Get out people outside. So when they had the anesthesia, which was great, they didn't know what they were doing at that period of time, but they were outside, so they had a good interflow of the oxygen from the outside, which flowed through these soldiers who they were going under anesthetic agents, and it made them easier to recover from the anesthetic agent.
Well, it probably
they would have been closed up in like a little hospital area inside of a house, then that anesthetic agent might have taken over and taken their lives.
Might have influenced
the 1.9% deaths from anesthesia.
But it might have put some of the surgeons under, conceivably, couldn't it?
If you start breathing that stuff.
And I imagine being outside in a tent under the bright sunshine, the lighting would be better.
Oh yeah, that's for true. Because if you're going to sit there, but these surgeons that I talk about Gettysburg, they worked for 72 hours after the Battle of Gettysburg, taking care of, and they worked for 72 hours straight. So they're working daylight, nightlight, and a lot of these guys. There was one surgeon that lost his eyesight because he was so overcome by what he had to endure for operating for all these hours, and he lost his eyesight.
No kidding.
Yes.
Wow. And I imagine if you're operating outside, the kind of odors that would be associated with a medical hospital with all of these wounded people. That also would probably be an advantage to not have operations going on in an enclosed area.
Oh, you don't want to be in a hospital. You don't want to be in a hospital. In fact, when they set up these field hospitals after the Battle of like Antietam and Gettysburg, they would set up these big field hospitals where they brought these tents in, and what they would bring is evergreens. They would cut down all the pine trees, evergreen trees, and put them around the tents because it made the stench a lot easier.
Well, we didn't have a Glade air freshener back then. And we didn't have electric lights either.
No. You had kerosene lights and candlelight. And that's how the biggest thing, after the Battle of Antietam, we had 23,000 casualties in it. And that's my favorite battlefield, if you don't know it. But after 12 hours, there were 23,000 casualties. And all these casualties are being brought back to a hospital site. And on the battle was fought on the 17th of September. On the 18th, General Lee pulled his army across the River of Potomac. And all these Confederates and everything was left. And one surgeon was looking, and he was at a hospital, the Poppenberger Farm, and all he wanted to do was some candles. He wanted some candles. And who showed up? Clara Barton. Clara Barton brought supplies on transport wagons, and she said, "What do you need?" And I said, "I need some candles and kerosene lights so I can continue to operate."
Brett Barker?
One thing I wanted to mention about Antietam, and it's also a favorite battlefield of mine, I think a lot of Americans, when they think about the losses during the Civil War, don't recognize the sheer volume. More Americans died at Antietam than at any other single day in our nation's history. More Americans died on September 17th, 1862, than died on D-Day or on 9/11. I mean, that is still the bloodiest day in American history, and I think the sheer toll sometimes astounds people even 150 years later.
And a much smaller population in the United States at that time.
Almost exactly one-tenth what we have today.
So you think of the percentage of American citizens who were being killed on one day. It's mind-boggling.
Right, 31 million Americans in 1860, about 310 million a day. So the death toll during the Civil War would be the equivalent of losing 6.2 million Americans in one war in 4 years today, and you can imagine what the social impact of that would be.
Oh my God! You talk about D-Day, where you lost 6,000 on a beachhead, and it's unbelievable. If we, like you said, Doctor, all this could what you're trying to prevail, but 23,000, and it wasn't even one day; it was just 12 hours.
Right.
We're talking to Brett Barker, UW Marathon County History Professor, and also Dr. Gordon Dahman, who is the founder of the National Museum of Civil War Medicine.
Hey, I'm just Gordy. That's fine.
Gordy. Gordy will be speaking at the Woodson History Center in Wausau on McIndoe Street downtown, 2 o'clock in the afternoon on Saturday. If you've got questions about this subject, it's a fascinating one. We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio.
Support for WPR comes from Rely Local Wausau, building the local economy and strengthening the community by making local business everybody's business. More about locally owned and operated businesses at relylocal.com.
And our forecast for north central Wisconsin: becoming mostly cloudy tonight, a low of 24. Friday, light snow throughout the day and into the evening. Maybe 3 to 5 inches of new snow, a high of 35, a low of 15. Saturday, partly sunny with scattered flurries, a high of 28, a low of 5 above zero. Sunday, partly sunny, a high of 28, a low of 15. We've got cloudy skies across north central Wisconsin. 36 degrees in Woodruff, Land O'Lakes, Phillips, and Wapaka. 34 in Rhinelander and Eagle River. 33 in Wetoma. 28 in Medford. 30 in Mosinee and Stevens Point. 32 degrees in Tomahawk, Wisconsin Rapids, Antigo, and Wausau. I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio with Brett Barker of UW Marathon County, and also Gordy Dahman, who is going to be lecturing on Civil War medicine at the Woodson History Center this Saturday at 2 o'clock. Gordy, this book that you published on images of the Civil War, you know, you've got a number of previously unpublished early photos. This was really the first war that was documented with photography.
That's true. The first battle was Antietam, when doctor, I'm looking for the name, he came down and he brought his photographers down to Antietam on the 18th, 19th, and they started taking photographs, wet plates, of the carnage of war. And I think it's something that we don't even look at. All of a sudden, that war was before Antietam. They looked at lithographs, and people draw some, mm-hmm. But once you see a body dying or dead, and it's grossly deformed, and what he did, they took these photographs, and they took them to his gallery up in New York City, and he charged so many dollars to get through these galleries to see the horrors of war. And what he did, he brought the horrors of war into the parlors of the United States.
Well, how did the American people, with their polite Victorian sensibilities, react to those gruesome images?
I think they reacted very gruesomely, because this is war. War is not a pleasant place to be. Nobody wants to be in war.
You know, you could say that this was the start of tabloid journalism. You know,
that's true.
I worked in television for a while in the city of Chicago, and we'd go to an accident scene or a car wreck or a fire, and you always had to wait to get the picture of the body being brought out of the building.
Yep.
Kind of a repulsive feature of what we were doing at the time. But in the case of the Civil War, maybe there was a positive effect in letting people know exactly what was actually happening on the field, and their idealized image of what war was all about, it really was contradicted by the facts on the ground.
Yeah, I think Matthew Brady's, talking about, right, Matthew Brady's photographic gallery, the New York Times said about that exhibit, you know, if Mr. Brady hasn't exactly come and dropped corpses on our doorstep, he's done something quite like it. And I think particularly the black and white images they're still troubling today. You know, those famous images of the Confederate dead along Hagerstown Turnpike, and they're pretty well-known images where they're just the dead left there after the battle. And I think people were getting it from lithographs and from other somewhat sentimentalized, romanticized images, and this presented a very stark black-and-white version of what the war was producing.
1-800-780-9742, 1-800-780-9742. Let's go to the phones. George in Friendship, you're on Route 51 with Gordy Dahman and Brett Barker.
Hi, I'm really excited to ask my question. I've got two Civil War ancestors. They're two great-granduncles, and both were injured within a few months of each other in 1862. I don't have much history on my family about the Civil War, and I'm wondering what their aftercare would have been like. The first one I'm thinking of was reported as killed in action at the Battle of Shiloh. He was with the 15th Illinois Infantry.
Okay.
And the second was his horse was killed. He was a cavalryman with the 8th Illinois Cavalry, and he was injured severely in the ankle at the, I believe it was called the Second Battle of Malvern Hill in Virginia. So I'm kind of just curious about what you think, what kind of care they would have received, and why one may have been reported killed in action and how that was reversed and how that those sort of things worked out.
Gordy?
It's unbelievable. You talk about the 15th Illinois.
Yeah.
The 15th Illinois was recruited right here where I'm sitting in Lena, Illinois, Freeport, Illinois, and they fought at the Battle of Shiloh.
Yeah.
And it's unbelievable that you talk, and I get goosebumps when you're talking about that, because this guy fought with the guys in my home area within a 10-mile radius. Now, I don't know what happened to him. We got to research that more and what happened to him, but the hospital care and and Shiloh was the deadliest battle in 1862 before Antietam ever happened. And that happened in April of 1862. So in the headlines came out like, my God, we've got 3,000, 4,000, 15,000 casualties. And this is the first time it ever hit, you know, the Battle of First Bull Run. It only hit, well, I hate to say this, but 3,000 casualties, but just 3,000. There are 3,000 young men, both north and south, that died. But now we got 15,000, and then it's going to grow to 23,000, and then off and on and on. But unbelievable, but you talk about the 15th, and what was the other part of your question? I can't.
Oh, well, for both of my great-granduncles, I'm wondering what their care would have been like. I'm assuming that if one uncle was reported as killed in action, that his injuries might have been quite severe, and maybe just one of the soldiers who might have been set aside in sort of a triage-type approach would have said that one's going to die.
At the Battle of Shiloh, there was a surgeon by the name of McDowell, and he was a forerunner, almost like my hero of Letterman, but he set up these tent hospitals where they bring in the casualties, and he started a triage system. And this was long before, this was a couple of months before Letterman set up his system in later in 1862. But they started bringing in the casualties. They didn't have a great ambulance system in that system. So they brought them in, and they kind of did a triage, and they looked at the casualties, and they say, okay, who can we help, and who's going to die within 20 minutes? So, and we did the same thing in Vietnam. I was a triage officer in Vietnam. We bring these guys in off the choppers, and you look at them, and who's the first one you got to go into an operating area? The ones you can help, the ones that are badly wounded, and they're not going to survive another hour. And it's even in the hospitals today. You got a mass casualty in any place in the area, and you bring these casualties in, and say it's a bus accident. You got 30 people. So you're going to look, and the triage person's going to have to look and say, who can we help now? And who is maybe not maybe, but we can help them later. So that's what it's all about.
Well, there are happy endings to both stories. Both of my great-granduncles recuperated for a number of years.
Despite the one being declared dead at the scene?
Yeah, he recuperated. And he signed up with the 134th Illinois Infantry for the 100-day recruitment plan in 1864.
Wow.
And the other uncle signed up with the 9th Illinois Cavalry and completed his service mustering out in October of 1865.
You know their names? Because I'm writing this down because I you know, if being in Illinois, because I like Shiloh.
Okay.
So.
In the 15th Illinois Infantry, that was my great-granduncle Thomas D. Corkill, Corkill. He was born in the Isle of Man.
Okay.
And arrived with his father here, so he was an immigrant. The other uncle was born in Illinois. in the McHenry, Illinois area.
Okay.
And his name was Sylvanus. It was S-Y-L-V-A-N-U-S.
Yeah.
Howard Brott, B-R-O-T-T.
Do you have some of the data from them, like if you go to the archives?
Yeah. I could check out your website or email address and send you some things. It would be great to get your help.
That'd be cool because, you know, the archives got some stuff, and it's really neat because you can research them back. And I don't know much about the 9th Illinois Cavalry. I know a lot about the 8th Illinois Cavalry, but 134th, we could, you know, there's a good place. I'm gonna do something. There's a great museum not too far from you guys. It's down at Kenosha.
Oh, okay.
Kenosha Civil War Museum.
Brett is shaking his head, so apparently it's a good place to go.
Yeah.
My son is the curator.
Oh, great.
Doug Dahman is the curator, and they do a lot of research down there. So I would contact the Kenosha Civil War Museum down in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and ask, you know, talk to Doug or talk to somebody there, and they can do a lot of research because they got all the records of this area around here.
And you know, there's an interesting kind of sidelight to this story as Wisconsin, as far as the Shiloh. You know, that battle was so horrific, and there was such a medical need afterwards that really the Union Army wasn't prepared for what was necessary. So Wisconsin's governor, Lewis Harvey, led a relief expedition down with nurses and doctors and medical supplies to send to help the situation. And while he was down there, our governor actually, while walking from one steamboat to another, fell off the gangplank and drowned in the Tennessee River.
Yep.
And so one of Wisconsin's Civil War governors died leading a relief expedition to Tennessee in April of 1862.
Wow.
Yeah, I visited his grave at Forest Hill Cemetery in Madison.
Yes.
And his widow became one of the driving forces for hospital and medical care during the Civil War. Was because of her.
Yeah, Cordelia Harvey. That's right. She went
right
to Lincoln and got him to set up a system of hospitals throughout the North.
Wisconsin has a great, a great literature of how people help people. Wisconsin was a great place to be.
And it still is. Gordy, we got to take a quick break. George, thanks so much for the phone call.
You're welcome. Thank you for the help.
1-800-780-9742 if you'd like to join the conversation. I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. Our guest today, Dr. Brett Barker, who is a professor at UW-Marathon County, whose area of specialty is the Civil War, and Dr. Gordon Dahman, who founded the National Museum of Civil War Medicine and who will be speaking at the Wausau History Center, the Woodson History Center in Wausau, on Saturday at 2 o'clock. Gordy, your talk focuses on one man in particular, Dr. Jonathan Letterman, who became medical director of the Army of the Potomac under General McClellan. Why was he so significant?
You talk about heroes. You know, everybody has a hero of the Civil War. You know, in the South, they talk about Stonewall Jackson, Robert E. Lee. But Jonathan Letterman was he started battlefield medicine. He's the father of battlefield medicine. What he did when he came on board in 1862 after the Peninsula Campaign in July or April, May, June, July of 1862, and the medical corps of the Union Army was in chaos, not because Tripler did a bad job, but Tripler was kind of overwhelmed. But you need some people that are, I want to say, that are above. And we had three people at that time.
My understanding about Letterman is that he came up with three innovations, an ambulance corps to pull the wounded off the field, a field hospital for emergency treatment, and then a large hospital further away for longer-term care.
And also a supply system. But he was an innovator, but he also had an innovator who was his boss in Washington, D.C., William E. Hamblin, who was the Surgeon General.
Now, did Letterman begin the Army Field Hospital as it's known today, the same kind of triage system used by Patton's Army in World War II and the MASH hospitals in the Korean War?
What he did, he set up the ambulance system on August the 2, 1862, where now I have an ambulance system that goes out, and he also set up a field hospital system where surgeons would go out onto the field within 60 yards of the battlefield, find a place where they could be safe, and they would set up field dressing stations. And from them, the patients would be brought back, and the surgeons there would take care of them and send them back. If the ones that weren't badly wounded would send them back to the battle lines. But the other, they'd call for stretcher bearers, and they would call for ambulances, send them back to the field hospitals, which were basically 2 to 3 miles behind the battle lines.
And this plan of his, in your book you mentioned that it was first used at the Battle of Antietam, which we've been talking about a lot, and it allowed the medics to remove 23,000 people from that battlefield within just 24 hours, something that had never happened before.
No. We go back to Bull Run, which was a year before, in 1861. 3,000 casualties lay on a battlefield for almost 2 or 3 weeks before almost civilians would come out with their wagons and take these people off. Now, after the Battle of Antietam, which was a fledgling system, you know, this was just begun, but Letterman had set the system up so he had an ambulance system. Within 24, 48 hours, he had all the casualties, including Confederate casualties, into a hospital environment.
Why did they call those early ambulances gutbusters?
Well, the first ones were two-wheeled ambulances. And you can imagine a two-wheeled wagon, and you put four people into this thing, and this thing going back and forth. And no, with no springs. But Letterman had a plan, and he did this in Wheeling, and they come up with the Wheeling Rudiger ambulance, and it was a four-wheeled ambulance with springs, and it had its own hot water supply, and it had two men that would advance it with it, and with horses, and they would pull these men off the battlefield without too much trauma.
Now, there's a picture in your book of Union Army ambulances lined up all in a row, ready to go into action. Is that the first time something like that happened?
Letterman had it set up. He set it up with a core system. On August 2nd, 1862, it was General Orders 147, where he set this whole thing up, where it was now under the medical director, not the quartermaster anymore. It was under the medical director of the whole army, and then they had core medical directors who would assign where these ambulances would go. And the core ambulances are under a captain, and then they would go down to lieutenants and all the way down. So now you talk about morale. When I was in Vietnam, you talk about being wounded. You wanted to get out of that area, and we brought these choppers in, the dust-off choppers, and they would pick these men off, and in 20 minutes, they're in a hospital environment. And morale goes up because men know if they're going to get hit and wounded, they're going to get out of that area. And the same thing in the Civil War. Before Antietam, they didn't know if nobody's going to pick them up. But now they knew that the Letterman system was working, and they're going to get picked out of the battlefield. They're going to get into a hospital environment and get out of that area.
Yeah, I think it's remarkable that people don't realize today we have such a different professional procedures to get. We talk about the golden hour now in battlefield of medicine and evacuation. And before Letterman, there really is no systematic way. People are doing their best, but as Gordy mentioned, there just isn't a system of really handling the wounded, and in very small conflicts and ones without many casualties, that can work. But the Civil War just absolutely demanded that more of a system be devised because of the sheer numbers of wounded after battles.
Well, isn't it true that a lot of people died from amputation simply because they were done so late in the process after infection had set in?
Well, Letterman set up, and the whole system that he set up, and the medical theory at that time was due primary amputations, do it within 24 to 48 hours. Because if you don't do it before that, then, like you say, inflammation is going to set in, infection is going to set in. If they do it quickly, and Letterman took a lot of heat. Because
and if you cut into that localized infection, that's what causes it to spread into the bloodstream, correct?
That's right, yeah, because then you got the gangrene setting in and all the rest of the microorganism, which they didn't know about at that time.
They had no idea about bacteria causing infections. They didn't.
No
way. They didn't know that they should, for instance, boil their instruments before doing an incision.
Wash hands regularly. They're just the whole germ theory of disease. It just isn't the knowledge. So basically, what they're trying to treat is just treat as well as they can, and then they hope infection doesn't set in. And that's just why so many people end up not doing well in this situation.
You've got some horrendous pictures in the images of the Civil War book, Gordy. Hospital gangrene of a leg showing a huge open wound above an amputated leg.
Yep.
And this hospital gangrene, that's something that could actually be spread, correct, from patients to nurses.
It was spread, not nurses, but the surgeons who would handle a wound and then go to another wound without washing their hands. Now, I'm going to tell you a story. This is 1880. This is 1880s. I mean, this is 20 years past the Civil War. President Garfield was assassinated. Now, listen to this. President Garfield was shot in the back in the 1880s, and they brought him back to Washington, D.C., and they brought him back. And what did they do? This is 1880s. Now, this is past Lister. And the surgeon who was in charge of his care, wanted every day to find where the bullet was, where Garfield's body was, in his body. And he stuck his finger, his unsterilized finger, into this wound. Garfield was killed by a finger of this surgeon. And you know what the surgeon's name was? Bliss. Ignorance is bliss.
1-800-780-9742. Gordy Dahmann, Civil War expert. He'll be speaking at the Woodson History Center in Wausau, 2 o'clock in the afternoon on Saturday. Also, Brett Barker of UW-Marathon County. I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. Our forecast for north central Wisconsin, mostly cloudy tonight with a low of 24. Friday, light snow throughout the day and into the evening, about 3 to 5 inches, a high of 35. We've got cloudy skies, 32 degrees right now outside our studio in Wausau. I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51 with Associate Professor of History Brett Barker and Gordy Dahmann, who founded the National Museum of Civil War Medicine. He'll be speaking at the Woodson History Center 2 o'clock on Saturday. Gordy, you're a dentist by trade, and you've got an interesting chapter in your book about dental care. The thing that struck me most interesting is I never knew where the phrase 4F came from.
4F, because if you were an infantry soldier and you didn't have some front teeth because you had to bite this cartridge off to expose the bullet plus the
you needed your front teeth to load your gun, in other words.
That's right. You need to load that musket.
And if you didn't have your four front teeth, you were ineligible
4F.
You were 4F.
Yeah.
That's where it comes from, your four front teeth. And
that's
we still
right.
use the phrase 4F for medical disabilities for the armed services today. Amazing.
But also, at that period of time, you could get, if you couldn't roam the infantry weapon, you could go into the artillery.
Well, they'd find something for you to
do. We'll find something for you every time.
I want to talk a little bit about women during the Civil War. They played a really important role. And, you know, this might have been like one of the first major steps women took toward women's liberation, suffrage, and so on. They took on some responsibilities during that war, Gordy, that they had never taken on before.
That's a story that's, you know, that people ought to tell. You know, once we started the Civil War and these hospitals were established on the battlefield, so, okay, what's going to happen when these soldiers have to come back, convalesce in the big hospitals in the major cities of both North and the South? And they're going to have to bring these soldiers back, but who's going to take care of them? Well, the first of them were male nurses, and one of the biggest male nurses was Walt Whitman.
Mm-hmm.
And you read some of his poems, and he talks about Civil War medicine, and he's not very happy with what he's seen at the Battle of Fredericksburg and these other places. But he was a male nurse. But then all of a sudden, we got to take care of these soldiers, and the first ones were the Sisters of Catholic Sisters of Charity. That brought their services, both the Northern Army and the Southern Armies.
Talk a little bit about Florence Nightingale and Dorothea Dix.
Well, Nightingale did her thing in the Crimean War, which was in the late 1850s.
And she was in Turkey working at a British base hospital.
And she saw the abomination of these hospitals and how this place was, I mean, terrible.
But then Dorothea Dix kind of followed her example and became a very important figure during the Civil War.
And another one was Clara Barton. Clara Barton was another one that studied what Florence Nightingale did in the Crimean War and saw that these soldiers were not getting, you know, the government could only do so many things. The government was overtaxed in the early part of the war, especially medical. And Clara Barton and Dorothea Dix, and they said, we have to have a nursing corps. And both of them, well, Clara Barton was more of not a nurse, but more of a forerunner of what we call the Red Cross. But Dorothea Dix and Clara and these people in the South did the same thing.
Dix said,
we got to clean these things up.
Dix was persistent, determined, and even militant about nursing, correct?
You talk about Bickerdyke.
Mother Bickerdyke, right?
Bickerdyke was from our own north area. She was from Galesburg, Illinois, and she was called a cyclo in calico. And she went into these hospitals down in Mound City, Illinois, and she saw this thing as an abomination. And she went and said, you got to clean this thing up. And people would go say, well, who are you? You're just a woman. And, you know, the surgeons at that period, in the early part of the war, they didn't like women around them, really. I hate to tell it, you know. But all of a sudden it changed, and she got to General Grant and General Sherman, and she went to those guys and said, you got to clean up these hospitals. And they okayed this, and one of the surgeons said, well, how can she come in here and do this? Because she has a calling bigger than us.
Yeah, at one point, didn't General Sherman, when the officer complained, didn't General Sherman say, I can't do anything, she ranks me?
That's right. You got that one right. But
and they were...
It was unbelievable. She wouldn't say no. I'm going in there, I'm going to clean up. And her boys, even after the war, they called her boys.
And women were fundamental in starting the U.S. Sanitary Commission, which is something that really changed medical standards during the war.
Well, that was a different, you know, because this was kind of a church group, and the Sanitary Commission, when it was established, was supposed to establish some sanitary commissions in the camps. I mean, you know, all this other stuff was supposed to happen.
But all of a sudden,
then they got involved in this thing.
Yeah, you're right that they were even, at some points, getting surgeons dismissed for being negligent.
Yeah. Well, they got a surgeon general put in power, William A. Hammond. If it wasn't for the Sanitary Commission, William A. Hammond, who was the forerunner of American medicine, would have never been surgeon general. They went above Lincoln, and they went above Secretary of War Stanton.
Dr. Gordon Dahmen, we could talk about this forever, but we really can't because I've got a minute 45 seconds left for this radio program. Anything you'd like to add about what people can see at the Woodson History Center Saturday afternoon?
Well, this come over, and we'll talk about medicine. You're gonna have a whole misconception of what you're gonna think about Civil War medicine when you come over there.
Yep, that's this Saturday, and if you want to know about that or the time or any details, you can go to the website marathoncountyhistory.org or we find us on Facebook at Marathon County History.
Yeah,
thank you, gentlemen.
Fun.
We want to thank today's guest, Dr. Gordon Dahmann, the founder of the National Museum of Civil War Medicine and the author of Images of Civil War Medicine, A Photographic History, and the Pictorial Encyclopedia of Civil War Medical Instruments and Equipment. Also, UW-Marathon County Associate Professor of History, Dr. Brett Barker. And a reminder, Gordon Dahmann will be giving that free lecture at the Woodson History Museum. It's 2 o'clock in the afternoon this Saturday. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, and our on-air producer, Jane Ritger. Special music today by the South Beach Chamber Ensemble, recorded live in our Wisconsin Public Radio studios in Wausau. Next week on Route 51, we have a very special guest, William Kamkwamba, better known as the boy who harnessed the wind, and author of the autobiographical book with the same name. It's a story of a young man in Africa who, against all odds, built a wind energy system to help his village and his people. Mr. Kamkwamba will be sharing his story next week with audiences in Edgar and Wausau and with us right here on Route 51. Thanks for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin, and until next week, we're heading out of town.